sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The S&P has the worst week since November. Earnings season underway and Apple clips 388. We have Kerry Lutz here with us today talking about gold and all sorts of other things that I know he's interested in. And we got lots to discuss about moving forward. All this and much more on episode number 310 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It has definitely been a busy week that we just saw. We had a lot of movement in markets, and a lot of it was basically due to the lackluster earnings and disappointment on revenues that we saw from a huge block of companies that had reported last week. You know, we're in the midst of earnings season, and it is one of the most important times, probably next to economic news. And, you know, the headline news we'll put to the side for a second, because that's sometimes transitory, just, you know, a moment here, a moment there. But earnings is really important, because not only do we get the last quarter's earnings, but we get the outlook for companies on what they see is happening in the future. And you have to take that really as an important guideline to what is going to be the expectations, not only from analysts moving forward, but more importantly, the reality of what earnings are going to be given the current economic climate around the world. If you didn't know, by the way, I'm Andrew Horowitz. I'm the host of this show. Thanks for joining me. I really do have a great audience. I got to tell you something. I got some wonderful emails. Lots of thank yous for the idea of shorting the gold miners last week. And we've kind of bounced back and forth to short and long, short and long. Right now, we're a little bit short, small position there. But if, in fact, if gold can actually hold on to this 1,400 level that it kind of got towards, it kind of went down towards, I guess, about 1,320-ish last week, moved back up a little bit. It took another big nosedive down one evening, and then we saw a little bit of a stabilization and a push. Now, don't forget that Friday of last week was options expiration, and that is really a key issue to look at when we consider the fact that markets did pop back up on Friday after a couple of really lousy days. Gold moved back up. Oil started to move back up, although kind of stabilized and then didn't do much. Yet, at the same time, we saw this really nice rally on Friday, and the question that you have to ask yourself is this nothing more than the same as usual? Which is simply, hey, markets go down, great time to buy in. Any cash is laying around, let's buy the dips, and then we're off to the races all over again. Or on the other hand, was it something different? Was it the simple reaction to maybe some buying of the dip, but also the fact that, hey, it's options expiration, and there was some movement of underlying stocks trying to keep the options from either going underwater for those that are holding them, or making money for those of them on the other side. And depending on where the major firms have their bulk of their options, you know, where are we talking about they're going to try to pin this market? Now, a good example of that is Apple. There was a lot of interest at the $400 level because it really never clipped that area previously in the recent route that we've been seeing with Apple. So now what we have is probably a lot of players, and there was a big open interest at the $400 level. And when you have that, what happens is that dependent on where the strength is, you may see a movement that breaks that level or holds that level, depending if there's a lot of call buyers out there, a lot of maybe call sellers or put buyers. And what we saw was that the continuation of the movement down gave the opportunity for the short sellers, the call sellers, to really try to push that down sub 400. And they really held it down very, very well on Friday. As a matter of fact, the last couple of days, we saw it clip 388, right about 388, which is a pretty good support level. But at the same time, it turned around and tried its best. Oh, boy, did it try to get to $400 on Friday, but just couldn't do it. So what we're seeing is probably a good amount of protective buying to protect your positions on your options. And that probably happened also to a degree on Friday when it came to markets. Now, let's kind of really, you know, let's really undress the market of what happened on Friday. Because we didn't have any economic news that was really good. We didn't see anything really substantial. We did see some news out of the impotent G20 that talked about how, well, that we shouldn't see competitive devaluations of currencies. But yet at the same time, a few people did say, hey, what the Japan is doing and, you know, with the look at their monetary policy, and that's okay. It's, you know, so what happened? Of course, the yen broke down and started moving towards, you know, that $100 mark that they've been looking for. And that helped the market. But also we saw numbers out of Microsoft, out of Google, a few other companies, and we saw IBM. IBM itself, by the way, took 128 points off of the Dow on Friday, down about 8% on a really bad miss when it comes to earnings and EPS and revenues. And IBM is just one more of a string of companies in the computer and computer service technology area that has really been faltering. You look at some of the international competition in that area, like Infosys. A couple of weeks ago, they came out with earnings, and it was just an absolute bloodbath, down about 20 or so percent. This is a company out of India. And when we see that this is a continuing theme in the technology area, you know, you look at the chip business, you look at the personal computer business, HP and Dell, you look at now IBM, which is more of the corporate side. Look at what happened with Microsoft. Even though Microsoft came in with a decent number, there was a lot of cost cutting that went on there that really got it to that level. And it really wasn't a great level anyway. It was just kind of a rebound from a really sold off position over the last couple of weeks due to the lackluster demand for PCs. So when we're looking at upcoming, for example, Intel, you know, and you have the recent numbers on Google, which were better than expected in terms of some of the components, but there was a variety of revenue items that were very questionable when it came to Google. It was not a great number. As a matter of fact, you see that it popped up initially after market, and then it kind of came back, and it kind of slowly kind of faded, and into the next day, we saw that the NASDAQ 100, NASDAQ went down into the morning on Friday, and then it kind of popped back up. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that, man, look at IBM's numbers. These are horrible. Look at Google's numbers. They're nearly not so good, but they're just not terrible. Might as well pick one of the better ones out of this whole rotten grouping, and maybe that was why Google was bought. Google did help to bring up the NASDAQ pretty well on Friday. But it was pretty amazing that the Dow actually maintained positive on Friday after a 128-point clip by IBM because of their weighting. Amazing. So what's going to happen? What are we doing? What are we looking at? What is the outlook for the markets? What is the outlook for earnings? I got to tell you something. Seriously, last week was not a great week for earnings. And this is exactly what I thought this was going to happen last quarter. I thought there was going to be some margin compression. I thought that because of the hiring, we're going to see some net earnings kind of fall down a bit. I thought that the currency headwinds were going to be a problem. That didn't really transpire. Not at all. What we did see, though, was a reduction in earnings estimates quite substantially over the last several weeks and also last quarter. So now we're really bringing it down. And the sales numbers or revenue brought down as well. And what we have now is an environment where we're starting to begin to see a shift by analysts. Now, that could bring two different things to the market. The first thing that it could bring is when companies do, in fact, report, and now they have reduced expectations, they could do better. So all the game of expectations versus reality and the analyst game of moving around the price points and price targets and then what's going to happen, and you know that's kind of the game that's played. The second thing that could happen is that we start seeing that the markets react to the fact that moving forward over the next couple of quarters, there is some pressure on earnings from a variety of areas. Whether or not GDP starts to do better or we see the hirings do better, the fact is that if earnings don't keep up and revenues in particular don't keep up, well, that's going to be a problem for markets. So you have two sides of the coin. You have the companies that have reported and maybe now analysts have brought down their estimates and they're kind of in line with where they think it should be. And on the other side, the companies that haven't reported yet, whereas there's very low expectations, and those companies may have an opportunity because they've been sold down maybe a little bit too far. Okay. So now what we have was, again, a Friday where there was a lot of volume because of options expiration, yet I don't think that we're going to see a big follow-through here. It is possible, and I wouldn't be surprised terribly if there was, by the way, because that's what we've seen. It's time and time again, the market's come down. You know, listen, the market's only down about 2% on the S&P from the high. You know, it looks like it's a big bloodbath over the last week or so. Really, only about 2% or so from the high. That is not much of a correction. There's still a lot of froth that is built into the pricing of many of these stocks because they were bid up so incredibly due to the fact that there was a lot of sentiment change in the beginning of the year, the yen being sold off, alternative assets being bought, whether it was European bonds, U.S. stocks, the dollar rising, so that was good for those players that were putting money into U.S. stocks who were foreign. They get the benefit of not only a rise in the dollar value, but they get the benefit of the rise of the stock, kind of a double benefit for you, for your investment, double bang for your buck, or for your yen, I guess. And now what you have is the scenario where the question is going to be how much more money is going to be put into this if we have some earnings concern, and on the same token, how much more is the yen going to devalue? I got to tell you, I was pretty surprised that the G20 didn't have anything to say after the week prior. There was all this squabbling by the U.S. and a variety of other countries saying, and particularly China, saying, hey, you know what? You can't do this at this rate. You can't keep on devaluing the yen at this rate because it's getting competitively very difficult for everybody else to play along. South Korea is probably one of the worst case scenarios. They're really hurt. They have direct competition with autos and electronics directly in Asia with Japan, and their currency is not doing what the Japanese yen is doing, therefore making it much less of a competitive player when it comes to the alternative of Japanese products. Now, what I'd like to see is, moving ahead next week, we have things like Netflix reporting. That will be all over the place. Intel is going to be reporting. And we're continuing to see that when banks report or the financials report, there's a bit of disappointment. GE reported last week. There was disappointment there. JP Morgan we saw, Goldman, Bank of America. All these companies really, I think, were bid up way too high compared to where their real future earnings streams are going to be. So pay attention to the earnings next week. Pay attention to not only the, as I always say, not only the earnings beats compared to expectations, earnings misses compared to expectations. Look at the revenues. That's really something that's important. And also look at the outlook if you can. We'll try to post a few of those things on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And we usually put at least a kind of an earnings cheat on the site so you can play along and follow what's happening. Now, I think it's important to mention a couple of things also that's happening around the world. There is the continuation of weakness in Europe. No surprise to anybody. We're seeing that the euro has been bouncing all over the place, and there's a lot of currency movement. Still seeing a lot of weakness in some of the emerging market areas, India and in Brazil, South America. A lot of it, again, due to currency issues. The real kind of miracle of miracles has been Japan with this tremendous rise, 57%, 58% since November of last year. That's quite an amazing move in the time frame that we're talking about. The thing, though, that I really want to focus on is a couple of things. We had the earthquake recently this weekend, in China, and we're going to find out what the fallout from that is. But we also have the flash index coming out for manufacturing this week for China. That's been very important because we are seeing a lot of disappointment about the potential for GDP growth, which came in about, 0.3, 0.4 lower than expectations, when expectations had been lowered already. GDP in the U.S. it looks like it's going to be, on a year-over-year basis, total 1 year, is about 3%, 2.8 to 3% right now, considering all the different inputs that you put in there. We're not seeing a great deal of manufacturing strength, clearly. We're not seeing a great deal of strength other than what we've seen in the service sector, which has been okay. Sentiment has definitely come down from a consumer standpoint, and that makes sense because we're starting to finally see the realization that there's less income due to the expiration of the tax holiday, the payroll tax holiday, and all the things that combine into making up sentiment. There's probably going to be less spending, which we did see in retail sales because wages have actually come down. So there's all these competing issues right now in the market that really have to be focused on. And I would say that it is not a time to be bullish by any standpoint. Selectively, yes. Stock by stock, fine. Theme by theme, fine. You want to say that, hey, I want to take a shot at gold here because it really kind of came down so much. And it's okay, fine. We'll talk a little bit about that. I know my friend Kerry is going to talk about that a bit because he's big on the area of gold. But again, earnings are an important factor when it comes to the markets. So I think the other thing that we want to really focus in on right now is the concept of this sell in May and go away. What is that all about? You've heard that before, right? Sell in May and go away. What we've seen in the past is a cycle that in the beginning of the year, there oftentimes is a pretty good quarter into April. Start getting to May, into the summer, what happens is that traders historically are trading less. They're going to the Hamptons. They're taking off time. They're on vacation. Earnings kind of start to slip a little bit into that season. And what happens is that we've seen some of the worst monthly returns for the S&P in that range, close to probably September, where it starts to pick up again. And then you get the whole idea that maybe there's going to be a Santa Claus rally and year-end move. And so right now, the concept of sell in May and go away is very interesting. One of the other things, put that to the side for a second, one of the other things that also is interesting is, I can't really prove this right now, but there's something that's been circling around my head. I have heard more times on radio or in articles or on TV that, for example, well, in January, whatever January does, the year does. Or, for example, February, one of the worst months of the quarter. Or April, one of the best months usually of the year. And I can't tell you how many times recently I've heard these kind of comments and the opposite happens. What is that all about? It's the same thing that happens when I talk about how there are all these people on one side of a trade, whether it's commodities or a stock. Look at Apple as a great example. Tremendous amount of interest. It was an 18% position in the NASDAQ. Now it's only 11% because of the drop. And because of that, there's more selling that happens. Look at what happened with oil, $97. Everybody was buying oil at every dip possible, and then it crashes. Nobody was selling their gold. It crashes. The commodity traders were more bullish than they've ever been. This is a theme that I have found to be very interesting, where everybody's on one side or the other. Bullish sentiment or bearish sentiment gets so dramatic that the opposite seems to occur. This is a contrarian investment philosophy. There are different philosophies. There's value, where investors will go out and they'll buy stocks that have good value in terms of valuation of their company, their books, price-to-book ratio. And what they'll do is they'll see a divergence and a discrepancy in what they believe is the price of the stock compared to where it should be. The stock may hold some value now or in the future, but it's beaten down and it's really a significantly a bad investment from clearly a technical view. Now, when you look at the other side, what you have is growth investing. And growth investing is all about not the valuation so much, but about the potential for earnings. And you're looking at a growth situation that you have the opportunity, like a biotech or technology traditionally can be a growth type of situation. You're looking for earnings acceleration. And there's divisions of that as well. There's momentum investing, which is taking growth stocks and finding them on a chart that's really moving up nicely. And there's a stream of from the bottom left to the top right of a movement of the price, and you hop on the train and you go along with it. Well, there's also contrarian investing, and there's many others, by the way, but there's contrarian investing, which is take the other side of the equation. If there has been a crash, well, let's buy it. If there's been a gigantic pop, let's sell it. If everybody is short one position, well, let's take a piece of that and think about maybe the opportunity for it to rise because of a short squeeze. So a contrarian investor, it's very similar to a value investor in a way, but they may not care as much for the valuation of the company rather than the directional move of the stock that or the commodity that has moved so far in one direction. So I just thought I'd kind of mention that. That is what is happening in some of these areas right now. It appears that there is a contrarian bias to many of the themes that we're seeing recently, and we're finding that money is flowing into where it's not and out of where it is. Does that make sense? But it takes a little time. There's a lag. It will continue building and building and building, then all of a sudden, wham, it'll continue to go down and down and down, then wham. Again, just look at what happened with oil recently. Look what happened with Apple. There's extremes that are being exhibited on either side, and they happened for a while in one direction, then very quickly in the other. A couple of things I want to mention before we get to our guest. There is, I think I mentioned this to you before, but we have been building some very cool indicators with a partner called Task Professional. One of the things that I really like to see is an indicator different than something like a moving average or a MACD or an RSI stochastics or any of the momentum or the trending or the oscillating indicators that you look at on charts. I like to see, well, where are the bulk of people buying and where are they not buying? Where are they selling and where are they not selling? And how do you identify with that? So what we did was we built this really, seriously, a very cool platform that you can use and you can identify this and even an algorithm that will show you simply red on the chart as the chart moves is a short or a sell and a green is a buy or a yellow is an alert. And an orange is simply, now this is on a chart. This isn't just in front of you. This is on the chart. We paint the chart colors. Orange is an exit, profit watch, we call it exit. And this is a algorithm on a chart, which you don't see very often, that will change dynamically dependent on exactly where the most important support, resistance, and key buying and selling based on volume and price. If you do anything and you follow market profile, this is something you want to take a look at. Now, you can get this on, for example, Bloomberg has it. They've accepted it, and they have the indicators. Some of them are free. Some of them are cost. You have it on NinjaTrader. You have it on, let's see, what else you have? You have MT4. You have eSignal. You have TradeStation. I feel like I'm missing a couple. I'm probably missing a couple there. The TradeStation one just went up. There is a light version. You could use it. If you have TradeStation, you go to the Strategy Network. And you look up Vega, V-E-G-A, that's the name of the algorithm. Or you look up TAS, T-A-S, Professional. And this is one that we built with our people. You'll see my name on there. You can get a light version of the Vega, which is free forever. It has only 10 stocks or so and commodities that you can use. So if you use TradeStation, you could do that. There's also trials available for the other indicators, which there's four or five others that you can get a trial of. And if you haven't used the Strategy Network on TradeStation, you really got to check it out. Very easy to do. I'll put a link to the area where you can get some of this. But you could also, like I said, if you want to get it through other channels, just write me over at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and we will get you right where you need to be. These are really neat indicators that you need to check out because it brings a whole new vision of what the markets are and how they actually operate. Different than probably you've seen before. And you have to get a little bit of learning just to understand the tutorials and how it goes and what it means and the lingo and the change in language that you're going to probably have to get used to about where you want to be. Do you want to be on the long side or do not be long? There's kind of that kind of discussion or breakdowns through fast zones or consolidations. Anyway, check it out. I'll put the link on thedisciplinedinvestor.com in the show notes of this particular podcast and this episode. And also, you can go over to TradeStation, check it out, and just go to the Strategy Network. Also, I'll mention real quickly that, of course, this episode is sponsored by our friends over at GoToMeeting, a great product by Citrix. And they have probably the premier meeting, virtual meeting system that's out there because it's so easy to use. I've used many of them that are very difficult, but just so easy to click a button and say, hey, I want to have a meeting right now. You can plan some in the future. You can do it by sharing documents. You could do it with whiteboards. You could do it by a face-to-face with their HD faces. You could do it on your computer, your Mac, your PC, your iPad, all sorts of ways to meet people to make it convenient for you so you don't have to really leave your office. You don't have to schlep around town and fight traffic and kill a lot of time, this is a great way to not only save money, but save time, which we could all use that. I could tell, you know, I could use that. Go over to gotomeeting.com because you can get a free 30-day trial. Click on the try it free button and use the promo code podcast, and you can get free access for 30 days to GoToMeeting. Great stuff. GoToMeeting.com, click the try it free button and put in the promo code podcast, and you get 30 days of free GoToMeeting. How do you like that? Pretty awesome. Great stuff. This week's guest is Kerry Lutz, and he's with the Financial Survival Network. Does about 20 or so 15 or 20 podcasts per week. This is a guy who really is energetic about what he does, what he talks about, and I thought we'd talk to him because some of the things that he focuses on is right in the epicenter of some of the things that are concerning people right now. So, Kerry, how are you, buddy? It's been a while.
Hey, it's good to talk to you again, Andrew. And, yeah, it's been a while, but life goes on, right?
Right. So one of the things I know that you do spend a lot of time with is, or you talk about a bit, is the whole kind of some of the hard assets, you know, the things that are tangible and some of the problems with intangible assets, such as stocks or money or, you know, currency and things of that nature. And I know that you have been a big fan for a long time of gold and all. And obviously, you know, the last couple of weeks, 3 weeks, or let's just even call it 2013, has not been the friendliest to gold. And then the recent debacle we had, you know, kind of caused some stuff. So I wanted to talk to you about what you thought was going on. I have my own theory on this and we could talk about, but what's going on with gold? What is the problem?
Well, you know, it's been in a bull market for 12 years, and these types of pullbacks aren't unusual. I think there's also some pressure from the Western central banks to kind of undermine faith in gold, because gold in the final analysis, unlike your paper dollars in your pocket, never goes down to zero. It always has some value. And the fact is that the governments don't really like gold. It's the old barbarous relic thing that, you know, when gold is going up, that means the value of currency is going down. And that's a undermining of confidence, central bankers' worst nightmare.
So, but at the same time, I mean, we've had some currencies obviously go kaput or at least get devalued to a point, to, you know, this is the old Zimbabwe story, right? You know, we've had that. The dollar in terms of inflation has been, you know, kind of slowly but surely melting away, although it's, you know, from other areas, it's other countries, it's more evident versus being inside of the U.S., of course. We have the yen where they're actually pressuring, I mean, you know, without question, pressuring to move that down because it's valued so highly. And that's also the problem in a way with having currency is that you have multiple currencies. It's not like you have multiple golds or multiple silvers. You know, you have either gold and here's the price, and there's the price of silver, or there's the price of this type of oil. But with currencies, you have so many different currencies out there and so many different valuations that it makes a very unequal playing ground in terms of global economy, or does it?
Well, the U.S. has been in the enviable position of being the world's reserve currency, you know, since Bretton Woods, and then even after the U.S. abandoned the last vestige of the gold standard in 1971 when Nixon closed the gold window. But then you've got this thing called the petrodollar, which all transactions in oil have to be done in dollars. And when countries have tried to break that bond, bad things have happened to them, mm-hmm. without getting it all conspiratorial. But, you know,
you mean like plane crashes in the middle of a mountain sometime in a small plane?
Like Libya kind of just imploding and Iraq getting invaded and all sorts of things, and not to get conspiratorial about it, but shall we say there is definitely a predisposition against any country trying to abandon or break the petrodollar. Mm-hmm. And really, when you get down to it, that's what's kept this whole thing afloat, because the world moves on energy. You can't have a modern economy without access to energy, preferably cheap energy, but energy nonetheless, and the ability of the U.S. to just print out unlimited amounts of the stuff and buy as much energy as it needed was really a great thing for the economy and for the dollar.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to the gold situation and putting aside, you know, maybe central banks undermining it and anything else that is going on, because central banks do own a heap of this stuff. But here's some of the things I have and I was thinking about that have been said have been the cause of some of this recent meltdown. There's a few things. You got the technicals. Okay, so that gold has been in a downtrend for X amount of months and, you know, kind of broke the support and it broke the trend line and kind of, you know, that was one thing. Then we have the idea that economies are getting better and therefore there's no need for the protection. We also have the discussion about inflation is ridiculously low and there's another whole batch of reasons why that is. And you know what? A lot of people are saying no more need for inflation protection. And then finally we have, which I think is the last two things are the most important, is number one is that we had that kind of announcement that the European leader said to Cyprus, hey, you need more money? That's great. But you know what? We're not giving it to you. Why don't you go sell your gold and your various commodity holdings? And the whole thought of a central bank selling, you know, how many billions of dollars worth of gold to kind of set things off. And finally, you have the yen, which is just this whole yen experiment, the great yen experiment that's being done right now in Japan with the amount of pressure they're putting on their currency and trying to prop up their economy and inflation. It kind of threw things into a bit of a weird loop. And so there's my thesis on that. I think the last two are the most important, but maybe we can go through those and you can tell me what you think or, you know, whatever you want to do. Just take it from there.
Oh, well, if you look at Cyprus, I think that was a watershed event for certain because look, what they tried to do originally was tax the small account holders who had been the beneficiaries of a ECB and the Cypriot government guaranteeing up to $130,000 in deposits. And then all of a sudden they say, oh, you know, 7%, that's your fair share of the bailout. So effectively that should have undermined confidence in bank and probably should have upped the demand for gold in that respect. Talking about the improving economy, I don't see it, you know. How do you judge a good economy? By the number of food stamp recipients, by the number of permanently unemployed, and by record low levels of labor force participation? I'm not seeing this recovery that supposedly is coming about, although you can argue that housing prices have stabilized or gotten better. And as long as Uncle Sam keeps guaranteeing 90% of the mortgages and keeping interest rates at artificially low rates so that you can get a 3.5% 30-year mortgage, maybe housing will continue. But you have to wonder, are interest rates at some point going to increase, and what will be the effect of that on the world economy?
But at the same time, let me just ask you something. I mean, you have to say, you know, if they're artificially low, that means they're artificially low because the economy is doing much better, and they're trying, if the word artificially low is used, that the economy is better than where interest rates should be. So are you saying that the economy is, listen, let's get down to brass tacks. We know that the economy is better than it was when it was just imploding. We know that. Is it at full steam? By no means, you know, for 100 different reasons, as you mentioned a few. Is it in a place where it can kind of hang out for a little while in terms of the overall economy? Yeah, it's not in a good place, but yes. The problem is it depends on what side of the fence you're on. If you're a corporation, you're doing much better because you're able to refinance and you laid off people and you have automation and all that. If you're an individual, you know, and you don't own a company, let's say, and you're at the mercy of a corporation and, you know, healthcare and all the things that go along with this, then you got a kind of a different problem, right?
Yeah, well, I would say I'd say there's definitely something to be said for that, but 70% of the economy, Andrew, is consumption,
mm-hmm.
The consumer. The consumer is strapped right now. Debts and credit cards still at very high levels, although lower than they were before the crash, largely due to bankruptcies and write-offs. So I'm not quite buying that the economy is healthy. I think it's being held up, especially in housing, but in other areas too, by the zero interest rate policy, the ZIRP policy. Mm-hmm. And you have to look at the fact that Ben Bernanke's in there buying at least $85 billion worth of bonds, a lot of mortgage-backed securities and treasuries, and that he's buying up 70% of all the debt being issued by the country, although I saw numbers that he bought over 100% of the debt that had been issued for a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then inflation, I mean, I don't know about you, but I just got my health insurance premium. It's up 10%. I filled up my car the other day with a non-inflationary tank of $65 gas.
Nice.
Yeah. Nice. I mean, if there, and then go to a restaurant, go to the supermarket, and you see what your dollar buys you. You know, you can't trust the CPI numbers because they use hedonics. They say, oh, steak's gotten expensive, so you'll eat chicken. And then if chicken gets too expensive, you'll just eat hamburgers with 60% hamburger helper in it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't buy the inflation numbers as they stand, but in a credit contraction, in a depression, certainly interest rates go down to virtually nothing in and of themselves because there's no demand for loans. Yes, you do see companies, large companies, borrowing with two hands in the bond market because they can get the money cheap to use at other times. But basically, loan demand has fallen off the cliff.
Yeah, no, I understand that. And I will say, though, just a couple of things and a couple of points there. I mean, I agree with you. We just wrote a piece for our quarterly called Invisible Inflation. It's kind of like, you know, the good news is if you live in a cave and you are a, you know, part of a family of hunter and gatherers, you know, you really have not experienced any inflation. And you know, you look at the numbers when they come out of the CPI and the PPI, you say, that makes sense. I'm kind of along with that. The problem is that if you eat, drink, you know, use a car, those are, you know, have been, you know, inflated, and those are not included in the core CPI number, of course. But nonetheless, some of that over the last, let's say, the 1 to 2 years. Well, we clearly know that there was a big crash of commodity prices back in 2008, 2009. Then we saw a gigantic rise, and everybody was really concerned about, hey, look at the rise here. Well, it was kind of like back to normal. Then we kind of started going the other way with gas prices, and it got really, you know, heady. And now we have another correction of sorts in corn, wheat, soybeans, in fuel prices. Not there yet, but you know, kind of kind of a move back on oil. So I think that we're going to see some, you know, potentially some food prices come down. Although, you know, where we buy it from had to raise prices to keep profitable, and the question is, are they going to lower them now? That usually doesn't seem to happen.
Yeah, that's always the case. When costs are going up, they're very quick to raise the prices to the consumer, and then when prices go down, if the prices decline at all, they go very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see the drug prices get cheaper, because that surely hasn't happened.
No.
In healthcare, you know, as long as you're well and you don't need health insurance and all that, and then let's not even talk about the hit from the increased tax rates,
right,
which are enormous, and Obamacare, which is another tax, and all sorts of medical professionals fleeing the profession because they've just had it and they're in a position where they can just retire or go do something else. There's a lot of negatives going on in this economy, and people are definitely unsure and uncertain. And the other thing, Andrew, is that physical demand for the metal, and I talk with bullion dealers quite a bit, and the people I talk with are wired into that network. Normally, you know, if Apple goes down 50% or 40%, less people are buying Apple because they're worried about it. In this case, gold went down 20%, and yet demand has shot up where they're selling more from the mint than ever before. All the suppliers I talk to are running very short on select items like 90% pre-1965 silver coins, junk silver as it's referred to, 1 ounce silver liberties. All of those, demand is through the roof. They can't get enough of them. There are supply reasons for it, but largely it's due to demand, and premiums are up too.
I thought that the mint had the lowest sales of gold last month than they have in years.
I'm not sure about that. I know in the first couple of months, their demand for silver has just been through the roof. And I think the last week they sold around 63,000 ounces, which was just, they never sold anywhere near that before. So in the past week with prices tanking, demand's gone up, which is a little bit anomalous. You don't usually see that in markets. Usually the best way to kill demand for an asset is to crater its price. And then, you know, people just stay away from it. Yeah. They say, oh, my God.
Well, you had the situation where there may be some gold selling from central banks. You had that. The CME raised the margins to about 7,100, I think, after this happened because, you know, they wanted to make sure that the margining was appropriate for the risk and obviously the volatility that's gone on here. I don't know what your projection is for gold. I mean, I know that you like gold. I get that. But, you know, it does look a bit, if you just look at a chart, forget about everything else just for a moment, because that's what a lot of people do that invest. And again, forget about the, you know, kind of the not coins and not any of that stuff, just the chart of the investment. I mean, the chart is a little broken right now.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It broke its support. It broke every moving average out there. No question. But one of the main reasons why you buy gold isn't so much for investment purposes, physical metal. You buy it as an insurance policy, and it's the same thing as your home insurance. Well, you don't think, you know, I had a great year in 2012. My house didn't burn down. I think I'll just cancel my homeowner's insurance because I don't need it. And it's the same thing with gold, is that if you're uncertain about central bank policies, if you believe that the current economic situation in the United States with these humongous deficits, as well as tens, if not hundreds of trillions in unfunded entitlements, is going to collapse the system at some point, you buy some gold, you put a modest amount of your total assets into the metals, and then you kind of lock it away or bury it or send it off to Singapore, wherever you decide to store it. And you say, if it really hits the fan, you know, and they really mess up, and let's face it, all fiat currencies eventually go to zero. That's been the history of fiat currency from time immemorial. Then you say, a little bit of precious metals, not a bad thing to own. And you don't look at the prices. So there's two markets here. There's what I would call the investment market, mm-hmm. which is your ETFs and your mining stocks and your futures at the COMEX, where certainly everything has gotten slaughtered at near depressionary levels. And then there is the physical market, which is a totally different animal. And for my own purposes, I tend to stay away from the paper market because there are sharks there, and I don't understand it. You really need to be a professional to go buy futures and options. It's not for me.
And what about the miners? Do you have any kind of thoughts on the miners? Because one of the things that's interesting, we've been kind of working back and forth with longs and shorts on the miners because they're very, very sensitive at this point in particular to, they have been for a while, but you're starting to get to a point where the miners potentially are going to have really big problems because as the price of gold moves, obviously the profitability of a miner moves. But one of the things that you have to look at is how much does it cost to actually, you know, dig and between employees and time and all this to get that ounce of gold, right? How much does it actually cost you? And there's estimates somewhere around the $1,200 range, which is pretty interesting if you think about it, because those prices obviously have gone up dramatically over the last, you know, 20 years or so, because they have to obviously be ahead of, you know, they have to be lower than the price of gold to make money. So now that you get so close to the, you know, the cost of production, these miners have just been obliterated. I mean, these stocks look horrible. And if you stay even in this range, you know, miners really are going to have a big problem here. They'll start shutting mines. They'll start, you know, slowing down production. Do you have any thoughts on any of the miners or the industry itself?
Well, yeah, it all depends if this is a temporary price, you know, collapse or if it's a long term. And I think we'll know more about that in the next few weeks. It's a guy I follow named Charles Nenner, who's master of the cycle. He pretty much called a crash, although not to the level where it is. Yeah, if prices don't go up, they will be shutting mines, just like they do with natural gas wells, just like oil wells. You know, at $2 a million BTU, they couldn't make any money on natural gas. At $4, it's a little bit more favorable. Same thing with mining, because it's a super energy intensive industry. You need energy to get the stuff out of the ground. You need energy to crunch it up, and then you need energy to melt it out, to smelt it. And hey, these miners could be in for a rough road, which is why you stick with the high quality Newmonts if you feel like that's where you want to be, which are, you know, some of the mining stocks are yielding really record yields. But if it continues on, at some point they'll have to cut their dividends and they'll get hit even more. So I can't say what the future is going to be. I don't think if you want gold, you should be buying miners, you know, maybe with a small part of your income, although they're at record lows, and that in itself could be an indicator of what's going to happen in the future.
Right. Actually, we've had Charles Netter on the show. Interesting fellow.
Yeah,
definitely
very
interesting fellow. What about the rest of the commodities or anything else that you're looking at? I know that we talked about a little bit of the economy and gold and silver. Silver is down, I think, close to, I want to say 50% from its high.
Yeah. You know,
and it's interesting because I've met people in the past who are very, very passionate about silver. And why not? I mean, when you had that kind of rise over, I don't know, a few years that really, I mean, silver really jammed up. And the concept is that silver is not only a precious metal, but it's also used in a lot of industrial types of applications. But that didn't seem to hold up. And if, in fact, the economy is slowing down, it kind of got to, you know, you have a problem, because if it's not being used as much in industrial applications, then that's not good for that particular metal, right?
Well, the industrial applications for silver, I think it's the second most used mineral. I don't remember what the other one was. But, you know, you see more applications coming about, whether it's solar cells, another industry that's depressed, or you're looking at athletic clothing that they put silver nanoparticles on to prevent body odor, water filtration. They keep on coming up with more and more uses for silver. And then you have to look at the recent Rio Tinto Kennecott mine collapse. Just in the U.S., 5 million ounces of silver a year come out of that mine. It's a copper mine. Big chunk of the nation's copper production comes out of it, too. I mean, if you've ever been there, it's in Utah. It's the biggest human excavation in history that can be seen from the moon, from satellites. Hmm. And this thing collapsed, and they don't know how long it's going to be out of business for. You know, that's something that depresses the supply. And you will see these marginal operators closing up. So silver, it's just got so many uses, and they continue. The demand is definitely much greater than the potential supply. And then the investment story, which is really what we tend to look at, has been pretty healthy. So, for instance, if you go back to 1999, it was $4 the ounce. Now I'm looking at my Kitco screen, it's $23.18. That still isn't a bad increase in 13, 14 years. Gold in 1999, 2000 was around $2.50. So now it's at $1,400. I don't say that I'm a permabull in gold. It's just that I see the reasons that you buy them, why you put it aside. I only see that case getting stronger. I mean, I think the concept of a responsible politician, that's basically an oxymoron. And until they come to terms with what's going on here in the economy, the bullish case for those metals remains.
I hear you. I mean, I've been, you know, in and out of gold. I've never really had a big interest in it, but that's a different story. The interesting thing is that I also think that the warping of prices due to the fact that we have ETFs that are, you know, storing this stuff, and the possible movement of that because of ETFs in general, just in general, that either invest synthetically through futures or other types of swaps, or they're housing it like GLD does and a couple others. I mean, that also creates a little bit of a artificial either interest or selling pressure on the metal. It's kind of nice if it wouldn't have had that per se, and it would trade a little bit more rationally between, you know, what prices are. But it is what it is, right?
You know, hey, Apple wasn't exactly trading rationally for a long time either, and yet it seemed to be, and then it turned out not to be.
Or then again, was it trading rationally then and not now? You have to look at, you know, depending on which side you're on, right?
Yeah, I love Apple. I love their products. I got a house full of them. I'm proud and embarrassed to say at the same time, and it makes my business and my ability to do things, they're tools for me. And, you know, great company. We don't know what's going to happen now that Jobs is gone. I'm not writing it off. But, and I honestly believe that Apple was the kind of stock, I know I'm digressing, that in the 30s, we made an amazing discovery during the Great Depression. Women still bought cosmetics.
Yep.
In fact,
the lipstick. More, the lipstick. So, yeah, right? Yeah. Lipstick indicator. Yeah. Sure.
Well, that's what I think Apple is in this day and age. Their sales have not really gone down at all. There's rumors that from their parts suppliers that demand's diminished. But I think Apple products are the lipstick of this depression.
Interesting. Well, I mean, Apple does, if nothing else, if at the end of the day, Apple does have still about $140, $150 billion of cash on the books, which makes its price-to-book ratio somewhere around 2.3, 2.4, something like that. And if, you know, if worse comes to worse, and it, you know, if you look at it as a cash cow, it's got some pretty good value there. But that's another story for another day. Yeah. Kerry Lutz, Financial Survival Network. And you can listen to his podcast and listen to him on a regular basis. And we'll put all the information on our show notes for this week's podcast. I appreciate you coming on.
Hey, it's always a pleasure, Andrew. Keep up the great work. We really appreciate what you do.
All right. Thanks so much. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, you make the decision whether or not you think gold is really the appropriate place for you right now, and if it is a place for you long term, if it does in fact have intrinsic value, and if it has the opportunity for you to save the grief of paper currencies going to zero. Are they? I don't know. Maybe inflation protection, possibly, for metals? Maybe. They're not showing that right now because there is no inflation, at least so the Fed says, right? That's what we're told. So that's what we have to believe. I guess that's what we'll believe. take a look at all the things that we are discussing over the next number of days. We're going to talk about earnings. We are going to talk about the Spearman indicator, because the Spearman indicator right now is in a slope down. And that is never a good thing when you see a change of direction and a divergence over the last 2 months in the direction of the Spearman indicator and the markets, because what you have there is a recipe for a continuation of a downtrend. Right now, we are clearly in a downtrend, and we will see if things do change, but it is right now in a downtrend environment. And oftentimes, you'll find that stocks generally will follow along. You'll have those few during earnings season. Clearly, that will bounce up and do all sorts of wondrous things. But with the lack of, any kind of positive catalyst right now, more than the central banks continuing to say they're going to pump money in and the IMF saying we have to do more for growth, et cetera, it's very unclear over the next few months. And maybe, in fact, the sell in May and go away is a wise thing to do. There's always opportunities, though. You have to look at this. There's always opportunities. You know, we talked about some of the bird flu companies that have been moving around quite aggressively. They move up 10, 15%. They move down 3 or 4, then another 3 or 4, then another 2%, and they move up 10%. There clearly is an issue in China right now when it comes to, and parts of Asia otherwise, that it comes to this new virus that's out that's pretty ugly. And we're going to keep an eye on that and watch for what happens in that area. I think the bank stocks are somewhat overdone at this point, and I would start looking at some of the companies that have been beaten down so dramatically that there's nowhere else to go. One of the ones that we've kind of looked at is, which is very disappointing. And we were in it, we got out of it, we shorted it, we made nice money on the short, could have made a lot more money if we held it. Trying to go both sides of this because there is a lot of volatility and opportunity at the same time on both sides. It's Cliffs Natural Resources. But even with natural gas price continuing to move higher, it doesn't seem to want to do anything. And that's really telling a bigger story, I think, for the industry. There is a short-term trade in there somewhere. There will continue to be a few percent either side of the equation. But until I see something that is a bit more than just movement of the stock due to quick trading, the coal space is really just horrendous. Gold miners as well. There's a big article in Barron's this weekend. Talks about how there's great upside in a few of them. That's possible. Of course, that's what Barron's does. They also said there was a 40% upside in Cliffs, which is interesting because they don't have that listed. You know, they do a weird thing about listing what stocks they pick and what stocks they don't. We actually list all them for DH Unplugged. If you want to check that out, there is a spreadsheet that we have through Google that when we talk about this little game we play, we put the stock on there. You can check out the performance of that at any given time over at dhunplugged.com. You just click on the button on the bottom. And I'll talk to John C. Dvorak on Tuesday night and bring up all sorts of interesting things that are happening around the world. We talk about some really crazy things on that show. We have a lot of fun. A little bit more open mic kind of concept than this show, where we have a lot more information that flows, hopefully, that you can use. Anyway, so next week we're going to really kind of dig into some of the earnings and see what the overall has been, because we're going to have a lot more data to compare, to work with, to come up with an answer to the question of, you know, is this a couple of companies? Is this isolated, or is this a bigger picture that is showing a significant amount of decay in earnings and in the future of earnings? So stay tuned for that as well. And if you have any questions, of course, just feel free to write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.